He's a paradox. He's at once an enigmatic figure and a famous figure within New Zealand literature. He belongs to that sort of golden generation of New Zealand writers and artists born in the teens and the 20s who kind of created a lot of what we think of now as our national art. People like Baxter, Hone Tuwhare, Con McCann, Alan Curnow. And he moved amongst them confidently. He published widely. He had many friendships. Towards the end of his life, which ended in 1995, he received a number of honours. He got an MBE. He published his selected poems. But at the same time, he was always something of an outsider. He was seen as, I think poet's poet is an accurate perception, he was seen as obscure. Even some of his friends struggled to understand his poems. I think his very good lifelong friend, Keith Sinclair, who grew up with him in Point Shev, and they stayed in touch, wrote poems for each other. Even Sinclair said it was tricky to understand his friend's poems. I think he compared them to Anglo-Saxon riddles, you know. And what we're now beginning to discover, I would argue, and a number of other sort of Smithyman scholars, if you can call us that, would argue, is that these poems are obscure because they were so ahead of their time. They're almost like coded messages to the future. We're sort of unravelling the code now in the 21st century. And one of the things I wanted to do in this book is just show how far ahead of his time he was and how much he's got to say to us now. Sometimes if somebody's a prophet, they're misunderstood in their own time. They have a message which becomes clear only in the future. And I think there's something of that quality in Smithyman.
He was accused by Loris Edmund of not writing poetry at all, wasn't he?
Yes, yes. And a number of other critics have had a go at him, and I sort of talk about that in the introduction to the book. To fully understand where Smithyman was coming from with his approach to poetry, it's necessary to understand a bit about his life. He had a very difficult life right through. He was born in poverty and grew up in poverty, at first in Dargaville and then in working-class Auckland, Point Chevalier mainly. His father was a Red Fed, a militant worker from the Red Federation of Labour, which staged the 1913 Great Strike, which almost brought down the New Zealand government's closest thing we've ever had to Bolshevik Revolution. And his father was persecuted for the rest of his life for his beliefs. He couldn't get a job. Kendrick inherited some of his father's left-wing beliefs and was also developing his own identity, was getting interested in literature, was flowering as a person, and then was subjected to quite a few difficult years in the 1940s. He was a young trainee teacher, and I talk in the introduction here about how teachers at Auckland at the beginning of World War II were subjected to quite a nasty sort of campaign of loyalty tests and things. And if you were a young lefty with a strong interest in the arts, it wasn't an easy time to be around, because there was we tend to forget this about the war now, but it was quite a repressive period in New Zealand society. Publications were shut down, including a lot of cultural literary publications like Tomorrow. People weren't able to speak out about their beliefs, and he was reading the very latest writing from Europe, from America. He was immersed in very radical, cutting-edge intellectuals, philosophers of the time, people like Heidegger, Wittgenstein, theologians like Karl Barth. He was reading the modernist poets. He was reading Ezra Pound, T.S. Eliot. And the rest of New Zealand hadn't caught up, and even his literary friends hadn't caught up. And so he struggled to express himself, and he chose to express himself in a way that a lot of people found obscure, because he believed that obscurity could be a virtue in the sense that it captured the complexity of a society. He didn't like the simplistic ways in which New Zealanders talked about themselves, talked about politics, you know, talked about their society. He didn't like simplistic ideas. He had a sort of a terror of simplistic thought, and he was always after more complex ways of capturing the world. So he created poems which have many layers of meaning. And if you approach them as though they're an IQ test or a crossword puzzle, which I think Loris Edmund did, you'll come to grief and you'll get very frustrated and you'll end up sort of racking your brain. But if you approach them as adventures, this is something I emphasise in the book, as layers to be excavated. Archaeology was a metaphor Smithyman loved to use, you know, so the sense of going down and finding out more and more and more. And if you approach them in that way, as a sort of intellectual adventure, then they're very satisfying, and they're poems you can come back to again and again.
A writer out of his time, a writer accused of being complex and a little obscure, but at the same time not an unpublished poet. We're talking about 12 volumes of poetry here, of published poems, but an even greater archive of material stored and left after his death. Tell me a little bit about how you found this archive. I mean, what was in it?
Well, the archive sort of took everybody by surprise, I think. Kendrick loved libraries. And as you know, every good library has to have a sort of an archive. You can't just have books on the shelf. You've got to have papers and, you know, bits and pieces and boxes. And he spent a lot of the last 15 years of his life sort of assembling this series of boxes full of poems. He was chopping and changing, was always trying to work out, trying to put this vast body of literature which he created throughout his life, not only poems, but also ethnographic essays, political polemics, essays about the state of education in New Zealand, all sorts of things, photos. There's hundreds and hundreds of extraordinary photos he took on his endless road trips around New Zealand. And he could never find a complete sort of order for them. As I sort of traversed these papers, I came to feel that I couldn't help to feel that Smithian was sort of playing games with us all, and that he actually didn't intend them ever to reach a perfect order. He decided, he was very fond of the pre-Socratic Greek philosopher Heraclitus, who said that, the best order in the world is a heap of random sweepings. And I think he'd kind of decided that chaos perhaps was a bit ultimately the best ordering principle for these papers. And so you go through the papers and you'll find, supposedly you've got an alphabetical ordering, but you'll find poems that shouldn't be where they are. You'll find photographs, you'll find bills, you'll find letters, you'll find doodles, little drawings and things, you know, stapled together with poems. You'll find multiple drafts of different poems together. It's a chaotic collection of papers, but it's also wonderfully exciting. In the introduction to the book, I sort of talk about the Portuguese poet Fernando Pessoa, who was famous for having this huge chest, and he put all of his papers in his chest, and people are still trying to sort out what's in his chest, and there's this sense that it's a magic chest. It's continually in flux, and there's new things appearing there all the time, and that's the feeling that a lot of people who've gone into some of the papers get.
Of the poems that you've collected in the new book of unpublished poems, what's the subject matter here and the technique that we're talking about? Is there a particular reason that you can see why these poems were unpublished?
There are many reasons why Smithyman didn't publish various poems. He was extraordinarily prolific. He would lose poems sometimes. He would forget about them, you know. They'd end up in a shoebox. But there are other reasons as well, more substantial reasons. There was, as I said earlier, a very conservative taste in New Zealand, and some of the things he was even managing to publish, he really had to fight with people like Charles Brash, the first editor of Landfall, for instance, to get poems into that journal, which is New Zealand's premier literary journal. He had to really struggle with these tortured correspondences backwards and forwards, and that's the stuff he did publish. When you look at the stuff he didn't publish, didn't even bother to submit, I mean, it blows your mind. He was doing things in the 50s, which are avant-garde now. You know, he was playing around with concrete poems. He was writing prose poems, decades before any other New Zealand poet. He was, throwing words around the page, experimenting with fragmented forms. He was doing all sorts of things.
How much is this going to change the critical opinion of him, though? I mean, we already knew that he was working in this kind of territory. Do these cast too much of a new light on it?
It's not only the stylistic innovation, which is startling, it's also the subject matter which he's addressing. We've found some poems and we've put them in this book, which show him as an absolute pioneer of intellectual trends that became much more prominent later in the 20th century, biculturalism. Quite fashionable now to talk about biculturalism. In the 1940s, it wasn't fashionable. But we now know, because of some of the poems in here, that Smithyman was absolutely passionate about reaching out to Maori culture at a time when most Pākehā intellectuals had no real interest in Maori, or if they did write about Maori, it was a very romanticised picture of pre-contact Maori society. But he doesn't just look at these things in a sort of pitying, patronising way. He also relates this to the plight of Pākehā and of Western society in general, because he perceives a spiritual crisis, and this is one of the themes of his work. He perceives a spiritual crisis in the West as well, and he's very interested in Peter Buck and Peter Buck's explorations of what actually happens to a culture when it loses its faith in the old gods. How does it find its way to the new gods? So he's continually drawing parallels and setting up a dialogue between Pākehā and Maori, and this is something which is way ahead of its time, and it's something that we can still learn from.